fathers are very important to God. After all, he is a father. And sets the right example for fatherhood in that he is a sharing individual and a caring individual. In the very beginning, there's a discussion that goes on in Genesis 1. I'll just reference it because most of us can quote it by heart. In it, it says, let us... People debate what us means, but no reason to debate it. Whoever is talking, we know that God is in the middle of it. And because he says, let us make man, let us be productive, let us produce mankind in our image, in our likeness, and let them have dominion over the earth. That is, let them rule and operate on the earth because I have an ultimate goal for them. You know, fathers, if they have vision, and I don't include myself in that, as I will mention as we go through this, you know, it's one thing to procreate. It's another thing to plan. Not the same things. Procreation can happen simply by action, just by living. But to plan, as God set down to do in the beginning, to orient your children in a certain direction. Look at the instruction that God gives in the very beginning to Adam. Before Eve is even created, he lets Adam do a job. He gives them a task to do, like we do our children as they grow older. We give them duties. We give them responsibilities. And the father, in this case, of the creator of the human beings, watched over Adam while he named all of the animals. And after he finished naming them, he set him down and then began to instruct him about something peculiar in the job task he gave him. You know, it's like the little boy walking through the park with his father. And he says to his dad, I believe I'm getting stronger. He's about 4 years old. You know, Dad, I'm getting stronger. Feel this, you know. I'm getting stronger, Dad. Really? You're getting stronger? Yeah, Dad, I'm pretty strong now. You want to watch me pick up this rock over here? A big rock sitting over in the park, you know. So he goes over to the rock and he tries to lift the rock. And, Dad, I don't think I can lift it. It's too heavy for me. Well, are you using all of your strength? The father says to the son. Are you using every ounce of strength available to you? Yeah, Dad, I'm really trying, but I just can't lift it up. And the father looked at him and says, are you sure you're using all of your strength? Yes, Dad. I'm trying as hard as I can, but I can't seem to lift it. And his father says, did you ask me to help you? That's using all your strength. And so relating back to the Garden of Eden, when Adam was put there, the thing that Adam forgot to do was to make an inquiry of his father in the circumstance he found himself in dealing with Eve and Satan in the garden. He didn't resort to God, didn't ask him at all. He just went on down the road and let things happen until it was too late. But if there is a relationship because of father to child, one can resort to that parent for help. And in this case, I'm just emphasizing the father. I'm emphasizing the father because it is a matter for our consideration. Now, when I think about my own life, with my children and so forth, and I was privileged to go to Los Angeles recently to my son's graduation. 34 years old, finally graduated from college. 16 years it took him to graduate. Now, you say, well, what is his problem? Well, he graduated magna cum laude. So it's not a brain problem. But because he started college here in Tyler Junior College, and he went down to Austin. I won't give you the whole trek. I mean, he was in Portland, Oregon, and then he went up to Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma for a minute, too, and went to five different schools and finally graduated. Well, today he's in China teaching English, where he has a year's contract teaching English and so forth. Now, I really can't take a whole lot of credit in that because, as I sat and talked with him in Los Angeles and confessed. You know, sometimes parents and fathers have to confess about the things that they didn't do. In the case of God the Father, he has no confession to make. He has made available everything that we need as his children if we would but reach out, or as Jesus put it, ask and you shall receive, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be open unto you. In my circumstance, I didn't realize until my children were well up into age that I didn't know what I was doing. Well, because I didn't see my father do it. And so on and so on. When you think about the condition of the world, and especially in the United States, and this worries me, I shouldn't say worry, that may be the wrong word to say, it concerns me. When I see children run amok, we read about them all the time. We read about the situations, as I reflect back in Tyler here, of the accidents that happen around graduation time because of parties with drinking that parents facilitate. I remember a horrific one out here on one of the country roads, car wrapped around a tree, where these young people had just left a party that had been facilitated by grown-ups, by the adults. Now, if fathers have their rightful place in a society and take responsibility for the things that God would have us do, many things would not happen as they happen. In the case of my son Aaron, I confessed and apologized for the conversations we didn't have, you know, because there should have been some conversations. When I think about God in the Garden of Eden and the conversation he had with Adam, he told him in chapter 2, now, all of this is yours. You can eat of all the trees in the garden. Now, there are two trees in the midst of the garden. You know, can you relate to this as fathers, limitations you place on children? Now, you can get your driver's license, but you should not drive above the speed limit. And you should buckle up your seatbelt. And you shouldn't drink while driving. You know, you give all of these instructions for their protection. And they get to decide whether they're going to obey it or not. In the case of Adam, he did not. As I looked at my son and I analyzed his situation, I was so pleased because here was a grown man who has only asked me one time in his adult life for any money to help pay rent. Just once. Now that's unusual. Even for grown children with houses and stuff. That's very unusual. Dad, can you, would you, you know, so forth and so on. So all of you with children anticipate that even when they're grown up, they're going to come back to the source. You know, the money that grows on the trees in your backyard, they're going to want some of that. But in the case of Aaron, I think it comes down to people praying for children and praying for situations. Sometimes it's the grandparents who are praying for this child to come to a place of growth and comprehension and steadfastness and all of that. So in his case, as I looked and listened to him, his choice of words, his manner of dress, his outlook, the clarity of his eyes and all that, and I said, wow, he's not a druggie. You know, he hadn't robbed anybody. He worked in restaurants waiting on tables. His last job before he went to China was being an eye guide or a seeing guide to blind people at the Blind Institute in Los Angeles. Wow, this is amazing. This is absolutely amazing that he made these choices. On my ride here yesterday, I listened to three speakers. I'll mention their names to you. One was Dr. Dobson. Everybody knows him from Focus on the Family. Then I got Dr. Tony Evans from Dallas. He's been to Tyler any number of times. And the last one was Dr. Charles Stanley. And all of them were talking on the same subject about fathers. And I said, well, as I left the airport, I think I was on the plane coming down here, I said, well, Father, could you give me something to talk about? Something to share with the people that will be positive and uplifting. You get beat up enough in this life, in this world, so what can I give you? Well, I got the answer in threes. I got from those three people. Now, I don't care what you think about them as religious people or their theologies and all of that kind of thing. Everyone seems to respect Dr. Dobson as a psychologist who works for the good of families and all of that. But I may have some theological differences with the other gentleman, but that's beside the point. I had an agreement with what they had to say. But Dr. Dobson shared something that was so profound. He said his great-grandfather, set aside every day of his life from the time of 11 to 12 o'clock every day to pray for his children. What? He did what? Every day? Prayed for his children? And I got to wrestling in my mind and thinking about that, because I've never done that, and it never crossed my mind to do that. As the world has gotten worse, it seems a right thing to do. But what really occurred to me, it wasn't my father who did that for me, it was my mother. I don't want to confuse anybody, but somebody prayed for somebody for us to be where we are today. We may not even know who it was, but I'm hoping that it's fathers who come up with the idea that I'm going to pray for my family. Turn over to the first chapter of the book of Job. You all know this story, but just to remind you of the type of man that Job was. Even in his plenty, even in his blessings, he had a concept of his children. Look at chapter 1 and verse 5. After recounting how much stuff Job had, and his sons and so forth were feasting, often got together at each one of the other's homes, maybe a cookout or something like that. Look at what he says in verse 5. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus did Job continually. What a father. What a guy. Now, that had to make it extremely hard on him when he gets the news that all of his sons, seven sons and three daughters, had been killed by the storm that came through and wiped out his family. You can see the question that would arise in his mind. God, why did you allow that to happen? I prayed, I sacrificed, I did everything that was possible for them, and yet my children have gone astray. You know, it is not a guarantee in having your children come to church with you that they're going to turn out all right. There's no guarantee that that's going to happen. But you must apply yourselves as heads of the family to that end. That's why the scriptures say, train up a child in the way he or she should go, so when they are old, they won't depart from it. Oh, they will wander around the landscape because they must try themselves. They must flex their wings and all of that. But they will not depart from it. It would be a terrible besmirch of the memory of the parent who had the dominant influence. In this case, I'm talking about the father. To wander off down the road, the path someplace, and become something antithetical to what your father wanted you to become. My father passed away back in 91, and I did his eulogy. I'm just a glutton for punishment. I did my mother's, I did my father's. I couldn't think of anybody at the time in Georgia who I wanted to do it, so I did it myself. My father was 72 when he passed away, and I was sitting in the office there on South Broadway when I got the call, our old office there, 7820 South Broadway. And had to catch a plane out that Tuesday to get to Atlanta because he, well, I won't go through the description of the circumstance he was in, but to deal with all the effects in the wake of his death and all of that. I concluded in giving my eulogy concerning him to be honest. And I said to the people, my father was not a good father, nor was he a good husband, but he was a good man. Because my father set an example that if I had eyes to see, I could understand it and comprehend it. And what he did was he worked all the days of his life. He was a barber by trade, opened his first barber shop when he was 17, still in high school. Used to charge 10 cents for a haircut, no, 15 cents for a haircut, 10 cents for a shave. How would you like to get one of those today, fellas? You know, and for 53 years, that's what he did. He owned his own barbershop all the days of his life, never worked a day in his life for anyone else. But he also trained young barbers, people who would ultimately going to be competition for him. That's what he did. And as I went through his effects after his death and saw his meticulous records of each chair, he had a five-chair barbershop, each barber, you know, what they made every day, and he never used a computer. He was faster than a computer with his pencil and pen. So as I looked and examined that and realized who this man was, that's why I said what I said. He was not a good father. He was not a good husband. He was married three times. So something didn't quite work for him in that regard. But because I made a determination to honor him in life and to go and sit and talk with him, the last time was in February of 1991. Charles Gross and I were up in Nashville dealing with the situation there, and I had driven there, so I decided to drive down to Atlanta and spend a night with him. And that very last night was what really settled me and sold me on who this man was. Because I never remember a day in my life him coming home from work, because he and my mother were separated when I was like two. I just never recall that. He did get me a baseball glove and a bat and baseball and all those kinds of things over the years, and would send money faithfully and all of that kind of thing. But the one thing I remembered was going to a track with him, the Arlington racetrack. And he had never gone to a racetrack with his friends, said, let's go. And so he hit the daily double for a couple hundred dollars or whatever. And then we went to eat at a nice restaurant and all that. I mean, I remember those moments like treasures, because that's what children want to do. They want to hold on to it. And fathers have to make themselves available in those circumstances, available to their children. Well, as I reflected on who this man was, it occurred to me that in his goodness and in the last night we spent together, he had waited up, you know, the meeting took longer in Nashville, and I'm driving down the road, and in those days I didn't have a cell phone to call, so you just keep driving until you get there. When I got there, he said, oh, I didn't know if you were going to make it, but I cooked some things there on the stove, and let's eat. So we ate and we sat and talked, and the very first time that I ever saw my father cry was in his reflection and appreciation for the job my mother had done with his children. And he said, I never had to get you out of jail. The girls were never in trouble because I appreciate how she took care of you all. And there he broke down and cried as a father who looked at the situation honestly and fairly and appreciatively of what had been his lot, his seed, if you will. And I mean, I couldn't help but be moved by that situation of what it meant. Now, I know that there are more perfect fathers, and maybe some of you have experienced that relationship. When I referenced forgive me, I can't remember your first name. Tell me quickly. Austin. Thank you, Austin. And I remember him coming. You see, I see a mother and father working together for Austin, you see. And there he is, in between them. Because the father in Steve wants to be better than what he experienced in life, to bring about this fine young man. I've struggled to find a text that I read last night, and I can't find it again, about the tribe of Asher. I'll just have to tell you the story, and you can look it up in your funk and wagon later. Some of you don't remember what was the name of that show with Goldie Hawn way back in the 60s, I think it was. They used to always say, look it up in your funk and wagon. The show Laugh-In, yeah. And so some of you don't remember that. That's what that reference was about. But Asher had sons who are described as men of valor. Asher. Not a tribe of the tribes of Israel we often think about. We really don't. We think about Judah. We think about Joseph. We think about others. But Asher is not one of those. Now, you can find the references in your Bible to Asher, and you'll come across this passage that describes the children of Asher and how steadfast and unmovable, warrior-like, ready to take on a challenge, prepared to take on a challenge. And you know it reflected all the way down to the generation of Jesus Christ? Because if you'll think about it in the account of Jesus being taken to the temple for his circumcision and purification, there was a woman of the tribe of Asher there named Anna, the prophetess. Remember? A descendant of Asher who found herself faithful to God because of the example that had been set over the years in the midst of her family, set in motion by her father, Asher. And the interesting thing about Asher and his genealogy is that he was not of Leah or Rachel. He was from the handmaiden Zilpah. She had four sons for Jacob, you know, back in that history. And yet somehow Asher matured and came to understand some things and passed it on to his sons and daughters. And as a result of that example, we find Anna faithful in the temple because of that conduit going all the way back to her father. Fathers are vital. The Book of Proverbs in particular talk a lot about fathers. If you'll turn over with me to the Book of Proverbs, the entire book in one sense is written by a father, Solomon, and he is sharing some things with children, if you will, like chapter 4 and verse 1. It says, hear, you children, the instruction of a father, and attend to no understanding. Now, I must pause for a moment and make this suggestion, because sometimes, in my case, and not growing up with a father present all the time, or in some cases, and I must share this with you, in the case of my two oldest grandchildren. I had a talk with them in Memphis recently, both of them, because sometimes as you reach 14, in the case of my grandson, Destin, and my granddaughter, Myra, she's 12, your biological father is not in your life. In one case, with the grandson, he's in jail for a very long time, maybe for life. But he's never been involved in his life. But look at what God does. My daughter Paula meets a young man, Lederick, they just simply call him Derek, who is the branch manager of a city bank in Memphis. She's a RAN. I mean, they're doing well. They live in a brand new 5-bedroom home, a bigger home than you could put all the homes I've ever lived in their home. Two brand new vehicles and so forth. I'm thinking, wow, this is really good. This is good, ain't it? You know. But I had to talk with my two oldest grandchildren and suggest to Destin. I said, Destin, you probably are having some feelings about your biological roots, if you will. And if you are, I want you to take a look and analyze what God has done for you. I mean, just think about the father who is the one who calls you son now, who functions as a father for you, who is concerned about you. See, what started this conversation, His father brought him to me, and he pulled his shirt up, and his underwear was up to his waist, and his pants were sagging down. See, I had the conversation with him about the origin of that. Grandfather had a conversation and said, that's from prison life. The origin of that style, I don't care if you like it or not, you need to know where it comes from. It's when they would not give belts to prisoners. And the homosexuality environment of prison was also, and we have a person who works in the prison system who can confirm that, Clifton Buchanan, it comes out of that. So here he is with the shirt pulled down over it so it's not seen. Well, his father brought him to me and says, I'm just fed up with trying to tell him about this. So I talked to him. I said, look at how you've been blessed. You've got your own room. You got everything you want. You even have a job working in a barbershop sweeping up on Saturdays. They don't observe the Sabbath, so let that slide by, please, without judgment. But he works there making a few bucks so he can buy some stuff for himself. And I said, did you not know that your grandfather, my father, was a barber? Actually, it's his great-grandfather, was a barber.
Really?
Yeah, he was a barber. That's how he made his living. And you're working in an environment where you might decide to even be that one day, own your own business and so forth. And you have to be careful about how you dress and how you appear to people. In other words, I spent some time talking and sharing with him as a grandfather to stand in place of a father who's standing in place of a father who's non-existent. That is reality in the world in which we live. The same was true for Myra, the 12-year-old. Doesn't even know him. And the sad part is I have another granddaughter in Detroit, same situation, has no clue about the sperm donor. Okay? And that will impact children significantly. But God always has a ram in the bush. That's what Mama used to tell me. A ram in the bush. Someone ready to take the place. In the case of Sharon, my oldest daughter, she married a young man, a Marine, he's a former Marine, but I tell you, it's nice to have him. If I need somebody, you know, to deal with some things, I got somebody who can deal with that for me, you know. One day, he stood on the porch, Nate is his name, Nathan, when my adoptive daughter or my stepdaughter, Destiny, some of you know her, some guy came to pick her up, and so he came out, Nathan came out on the porch with his, one of these big knives that they have from the military, and just proceeded to shave himself, you know, while this guy comes to pick her up, you know, just to indicate, you got any ideas, anything, you know, just want to let you know that there's somebody you got to deal with here, you see. So fathers do that. When Paula was pregnant with her, I hope you don't mind me being this reflective in a message, because I want to indicate the lessons that you can learn and the opportunities that God presents for us to matter to our children. Destin's biological father, I took Paula, and while she was pregnant, took them to dinner at Luby's, right over here, close by. And at that moment in time, I was not a happy camper. You know, I was not happy. She was 16. I was not happy at all. So, but I'm going to be containing myself. I'm not going to act a fool. So we went to a public place to sit down to talk. And I just indicated to him, I said, look, I don't know what you do. So you got this beeper on and all of that, and you're probably involved in a life that could be dangerous. But if anything should happen to my daughter or the child she's carrying, I don't call 911. Now, you may say, well, but you're a minister. What? I'm just telling you like it is. I don't call 911. It may take them forever to get there, to deal with you. So I will have to deal with you myself. He leaned across the table. He's about 20, 21, something like that, and said, is that a threat? And I leaned forward and said, it's a promise. I'm not from Tyler. I'm from Detroit. And he said, Detroit. Well, now I know Detroit has a bad reputation and all that, and I was playing my trump card because I even told him, I said, my daughter doesn't even know what I used to do in Detroit. Because I was 30, I think, when she was born, and back when I left to go to Pasadena, you know, she doesn't know anything about all of that. So you just put that in your pipe and smoke it. And I said, if you can't come correct, don't come around at all. And he's not been around. Because that's a father's responsibility. I said, look, this is my daughter. I'm responsible for her. I had a similar situation with my sister, my youngest sister, whose father is dead, and her husband had physically beat her and all kinds of things. When I found out about it, I went to Detroit. I had a performance with the Detroit Symphony. When I found him over in a drug alley someplace, I was in a tuxedo ready to go to a performance when I talked to him and said, leave my sister alone, do not call my mother out of her name, all of that kind of thing, because that is a father's responsibility. I said, but her father's dead. I'm her brother. Therefore, I stand in his place. That's what fathers do. And the thing that I'm trying to communicate with you is that we need more fathers to take their rightful place in the society, to stand up against some stuff that goes on that encroach upon the lives of our children. And if you can't be a biological father, be a surrogate one. Find somebody who needs nurturing and mentoring and provide that kind of thing for them. It will make all the difference. When I get back to Detroit, I've got to do a funeral on Monday for a 44-year-old man who was a former big-time drug dealer in the city of Detroit. We became very good friends. We eat in the same restaurant, and over the years, since I've been back in Detroit, we became very close, and he called me his mentor. That's what he called me, because we could talk about any number of things. When he died suddenly with a heart issue week before last, and I asked them to delay the funeral because I knew I had to be at different places, they did delay it till Monday. We talked about growing up and talked about the influences and impacts on our lives in a negative way because of the absence of a father figure in our lives. The thing that kept me on the straight and narrow was joining a male chorus when I was 12 years old. That's when I joined the Baptist Church. I was 12 years old. And went into the male chorus, and all of these men performed like fathers for me. If I started to say stuff like an adult, they would remind me very quickly, be quiet. And I don't agree with the term children should be seen and not heard, but I understand the principle. I understand because the book of Job shows us Elihu, the young man who sat and listened to the three older friends of Job, going through all of their machinations about what the problem was, and finally Elihu sought an opportunity to speak. He says, young men should give way to the hoary head, the white-haired person, and let them speak. Let them talk. But you guys have been off base, so I must speak up on behalf of the Creator. And he began to speak up, and immediately on the heels of that, the true Father shows up, God, to confirm exactly what this young man had said. So in my growing up, I began to understand something about what it means to have men in your lives when your biological father isn't present. So I had to mention that because sometimes children are confronted with that issue. But the interesting thing about the Creator is that he will make provision for you. And that was what I was sharing with my grandson and granddaughter recently, less than a month ago. That God has provided you with a father who cares for you. I reminded Meyer, I said, you know, we took a trip to Detroit one time from Tyler. And we stopped at a hotel in Kentucky someplace for the night. And we called your mother back. You remember that? We called back and you had a conversation. And what was your first question to her was, is Derek there? What's he doing? Is he watching TV? Why? Because she needed to have this father figure in her life, and this is the guy that Paula eventually married, who became that father figure. I said, now you're in a situation where you call him dad, he calls you daughter, then you're going to have to be more responsive and reflective on what you've been blessed with, because you've been blessed. Now, he may not be your biological father, but it doesn't matter. He loves you no less, because the person who created you is nowhere to be seen. And I digressed earlier. Taliba, my granddaughter in Detroit, she's 11. Let's see, 11 or 12. I lose track. But she has the same kind of situation. But I have no doubt that Paula's or Sharon's husband is going to stand in for any situation, any difficulty, just as if it was his biological child. That's what God provides. So if anything that I'm saying causes you to raise a question, well, see, you don't know my circumstance, you don't know my situation, you don't know this and you don't know that, God provides. Jesus once says, ask and you shall receive, seek and you shall find, knock and the door shall be opened unto you. A father's responsibility is awesome. Over in the book of Colossians, we find a passage that I think is instructive for us. Paul had this penchant of writing important things to people, and especially to families. Look at this is chapter 3 of Colossians, beginning in verse 18. Giving some order and structure to how a family should operate. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing unto the Lord. And then comes this statement to the fathers. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. And you know, I got to thinking back on that text of how I had to work like the Dickens, whatever the Dickens is. I think it's referring to Charles Dickens, but I don't know. I think he grew up in a workhouse in England at one time. But anyhow, I had to reflect back on it. That was the conversation, the tenor of the conversation with my son. I had to recognize how I provoked him. Because he's a son. You know, you figure you can toughen him up a little bit, threaten him a little bit, you know. When he was going to Robert E. Lee here, that's where he graduated from high school, and tried to play football a little bit. See, I had played football, I played basketball, I'd done so many things, and he was trying to stack himself up against all of that. Rather than be himself, you know, I'm expecting, well, you know, I need a star football player, I need a basketball player, I need this and I need that. As far as music is concerned, I think he might be a little tone deaf, you know. So I just kind of struck out in many ways, but I said things to him over the years and to my daughters as well that were discouragements. They were discouragements, and the scripture tells me as a father I shouldn't provoke my children and just say any old thing to them because I'm in charge, I'm the big boss, I can say it, because it will etch into their psyches and eventually contribute to their destruction or discouragement. And you have to work awfully hard to overcome it in the years ahead of you. Well, gratefully and thankfully, all of my children seem to love me now as a father. You know, I really do appreciate that, but God had to make me work and labor and go through some things with them to come to such a place. And the wonderful thing is that as a father and honoring their mother in their sights, because see, we went through a very tough divorce. Tough back in after 12 years of marriage. I mean, it was not pretty. But God kept me and showed me and worked with me, and somebody prayed for me. Now, I wish that I could say it was my father, My father used to say, well, I don't go to any church or anything like that, but I do have a relationship with the man upstairs. That's how he put it. And I said, oh, okay, Dad, I can appreciate that. We never got a chance to talk any theology. Never did get to talk any of that, but I knew that in his youth, when I was born, he was a deacon in the Methodist Church, and he was very active as a businessman and all that kind of thing, but we never went to church together. He never heard me preach, except maybe I think I might have sent him a tape or two or something like that. So I can't say that he prayed for me, but I know my mother did. I just know that she did. And sometimes mothers feel like they have to be surrogate fathers, you know, because there is the absence of that fatherly figure. And somewhere along the way, a child will want to have that father figure come around. Sometimes women marry people that remind them of their father or the father they hope they would have had on the basis of that emptiness. Final example I want to leave with you is of a friend of mine in Detroit. And this really settles the issue when you're talking about being a father. Over in the book of Romans, if you'll turn to the 8th chapter of Romans and just park out there for a moment as I tell you this story. A friend of mine, female, who had to grow up in a home of an adoptive mother who was the sister to her biological mother. That had to be tough all by itself, but then to find out this person's in their 40s, to find out that her father was a deacon, a leading deacon in one of the big Baptist churches in the city of Detroit. But her adoptive father was a minister in another church. And a biological mother, let me rephrase it so you get it right. A biological mother is the sister. The biological mother gave her daughter to her sister to raise. And the sister was married to a minister. The biological father was a deacon in the church. And she grew up knowing this over the years. He died about a year or two ago, the biological father. And I remember going to the funeral to support this person and how eerie it was, because here is the wife of this man who's died. Here is a daughter that is not even recognized in the obituary. But when you look at the man laying in the casket and you look at the daughter, you can't help but see it. Just can't help it. There it is. And she had to labor her way through that. And eventually she married a man older than she was, who perhaps was more paternal to her than a husband. And they have two daughters and all of that. But I've had conversations with her and said, you know, the experiences that you've had will benefit others down the road because you're in ministry. She's a deacon at this church, Baptist church, Sunday church, so you don't mistake it and conclude that it's part of the Church of God International. No, it's not. And she's now on the road to minister because they ordain women to ministry and all of that. So, but I said, you're going to have a ministry to people, or girls or children or young people just like you who've gone through that kind of experience. But the most important thing that we can remember in thinking about fathers is what we find here in the book of Romans, the 8th chapter, beginning in verse 14. Here is the encouragement to all of us. It says, for as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons, the children of God. For you have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear. And when you think about children growing up today, there is a fear in them at an early age that is manifested because of the absence of a secure home, headed by a father and a mother working alongside of each other. I don't have the stats to throw out to you, but it's well beyond 50%. if not more. And in the African American community, I got to tell you, it's 70%+. And when you're in a situation like that, and I reflect on it as a former teacher in the Detroit Public Schools, and I think about the children that I've talked with, the girls in particular. One seventh grader told me of the things that she had to deal with uncles, brothers, and other men who were around the house. Seventh grader that she had to endure. And she's talking to me as a teacher, which I have no power to address it, to do anything about it. None. Well, where is she going to find the help? And the fear and the apprehension and the bitterness that comes out of that circumstance is what is so horrendous. But here's what we are encouraged with in the scriptures. We have not received the spirit of bondage, again, to fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption, whereby you cry, Abba, Father. We have access to a father. Oh, he may not be able to hug you, but he will send somebody to hug you. You may not be able to sit down and have a meal with him, but he will allow you opportunity to have a meal with somebody who cares about you. You may not be able to have the kind of relationship with a physical father, but through human conduits, as well as the spiritual presence of an almighty God, you can have a relationship with the Father. The scriptures are clear on it. Look at it. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God. So you can bypass the physical limitations and move into a realm where you have a spiritual connection, a great spiritual connection. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified with him. It is an encouragement to know that there is someone like a creator who stands ready to stand in for that which is lacking, even in the case of providing a father to love you. When I was 12 and 13 years of age, there was a man, Sam Jones was his name, had a son about my age. And when he saw the circumstance, they began to invite me. The father began to invite me to go to baseball games, to the Tigers and so forth. And then they had a little baseball team, softball team. Come on out, watch the game. Come over to the house, you know, we're going to have a cookout or something. Come on by. There were men that God provided for me as father figures to help teach and instruct me in the ways to go. So now that I am old, I pray that I don't depart from it. Amen.